Welcome to the That's So Cincinnati podcast. I'm really excited today. You know, Sherry Coolidge is on vacation, and so we had to tap our good friend, the Grand Poobah of Gallipolis, Jason Williams.
Wow.
I know, I was prepared.
You were prepared. That's one of the best intros I've ever had.
I even pronounced it right, didn't I? Gallipolis.
There's two ways, Gallipolis or Gallipolis.
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 But not Gallipolis.
Not Gallipolis, no.
I had to actually remind myself how to say it. Well, welcome back to the podcast,
thanks.
Jason.
Great to be back. When you asked me to come on, I'm always eager to jump at the chance.
Well, and it's a very appropriate week to have you because we have had, and this happens quite a bit, for those listeners who don't remember, Jason was the political columnist before taking over as our sports columnist, but really the job's not that different because politics and sports tend to intersect a lot, especially in Cincinnati. And they intersected earlier this week with more talk about the lease expiring for Paycor Stadium. What's going on?
Well, just you know, Mike Brown spoke. He did his annual speaking to the media, and he was asked about the update on the stadium lease, and he was very clear about we're gonna keep this private and not play this out publicly. And no surprise there on his comments, but there were, and he was jumping from, there were three different media stations that is the preseason preview. Man, they do this every year, the mock turtle soup day, the Bengals call it.
And did you have some mock turtle soup?
I did not. I actually had to get back here to finish up another thing that I was working on, but I just did the interview stuff and then came back up to the office.
So we need to pause there on mock turtle soup because I've had it before.
You have? Okay. I've never had it.
So apparently, I mean, it's mock turtle soup, so it's not really turtle, but I think it, the flavoring dates back to when people actually ate turtle soup. Okay. And when I tried it, it's basically like minced ground beef, like pulverized in vinegar. That's what it tasted like to me. Yeah.
So maybe it looks the look of it looks like chili.
Yeah, it's brownish. It's I think it's got
like
a
Cincinnati style chili.
Yeah, Cincinnati, right, which we're not going to go down that rabbit hole. Yeah. But so you didn't have any mock, you've never had mock turtle turtle soup day. Does anyone eat it or do they just call it that?
Yeah, they have that, but they have other things with it. Yeah.
Like what, I was oyster watching crackers?
Yes, they're not oyster crackers. They were like kind of the round, flat crackers.
Ah, mock turtle crackers.
I guess.
All right. Sorry. I didn't mean to sidetrack us there. So,
but anyway, yeah, he's asked about the stadium lease. And I got a question in about the timetable. And, you know, he said he kind of joking was like, well, it's not going to happen this week. So I basically was like, is this going to go up until the lease deadline, the current lease runs out in 2026, or is it going to get done earlier than that? You know, we've reported multiple times that negotiations are underway, they're ongoing. What I found interesting, and I think there's a lot of reading between the lines of what Mike Brown said on a lot of things, Joe Burrow's contract and on the stadium, but he unsolicited said, we want to stay here long term. And he said that a couple different times, and maybe that was in different stations, but it was almost,
yeah,
it almost,
I wrote down his quote from our story, quote, believe me, we are not looking to run off, but we have to have something that works for us and works for our fans. So how do you read that?
I read that as they're going to use the whole, we're going to leave threat as a negotiating ploy, the NFL is a highly coveted business to have in your city. And if you don't, do a lot of what we want on this, then we'll threaten to leave. And that happens quite often when it comes to these stadium negotiations, to teams looking for new stadiums, and they always threaten to leave. Not always, but they're oftentimes, it is a negotiating ploy that, okay, if you're not going to give us what we want, then, hey, this city, I don't know, Austin, Texas has been a city that's been thrown out generally for an NFL team. I don't think that would happen because it's so close to Dallas. I can't see Jerry Jones wanting a team in Austin or allowing a team to come to Austin, but there will that to me, that comes off like this will be used as a negotiating ploy. Okay, well, we'll threaten to leave town.
And you can't blame him at this point. And now every time we say this or write this, we take a lot of heat from people. So I'll just try to qualify this as best I can. The deal that the Hamilton County taxpayers have for this stadium is among the worst by many, many measures.
No doubt.
Yeah. But in what I'll call the PB era, pre-Borough era, I think Mike Brown's threats rub people the wrong way. Look, we've already, the sales tax, the tax burden on this county for the two riverfront stadiums is still something that they are, that challenges them from a budget standpoint. And so, in the pre-Borough era, when they were losing, when they hadn't been to the playoffs, I think there was a sentiment in town that if Mike Brown made those threats, it would be answered with a, well, go ahead, we don't care. Mm-hmm. My, how things have changed.
Yeah.
I think he is in a good spot to make these negotiations right now.
No doubt.
Because he's got a winning product on the field. As we record this, there hasn't been an announcement on Joe Burrow's contract or T. Higgins' contract, but those are expected anytime now. No one is thinking that there's going to be any issue with locking down Joe Burrow and T. Higgins. So he is in the point, he is in the driver's seat right now, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, and I wrote a column about this very thing about how winning is giving them a newfound leverage in the stadium. Negotiations. I talked to a couple sports economists. I believe it was early last summer, I think, when I wrote it, or spring. And, it's no secret. It's no, but hey, you're a successful business. You can use that as a negotiating point. We're winning. Do you want a winning team in your town? Look what a winning Bengals team has done. And Mike Brown even talked about that a little bit the other day in terms of how the city has really just how exciting it is, how the city's really rallied around the team. And he even went on to talk about how he's really enjoying how the city's rallied around FC Cincinnati, the winning Reds, and the UC going to the Big 12, which I thought was cool of him to sort of mention the grander scope of sports landscape right now. But yeah, I mean, just the fact that, they have all this goodwill because of winning. And so that alone is going to put pressure on the commissioners. No commissioner is going to want to say, I'm the one who said, yeah, it's okay for the Bengals to leave town when they're contending for Super Bowls.
I think the dialogue has changed. I think prior to the winning seasons, and also just the engagement that the Bengals have had in the community now with the Ring of Honor. While this is going on, they're still moving forward with stadium. That was the other news that came out this week. There are enhancements that they've announced for Paycor Stadium, including, more concessions, faster concessions, artwork, other creature comforts. I think the dialogue politically prior to all of this was the commissioners, the county commissioners, their job was to get a better deal for the taxpayers. Now I think it has shifted to their job is to keep the Bengals in town. Mm. Don't you think?
I think it's a balancing act of both. And I talked about that in my, in the column as well. And I think it's a really, really hard position for them because at the end of the day, I mean, it is their job to get the best deal for the taxpayers. That's why they're voted there. That's their job by definition. But you're right.
And I think now it comes into the discussion that a good deal for the taxpayers is to have the economic boost that the Bengals have brought since they started winning.
I think that's part of it. I still think the biggest question, I'm kicking myself for I didn't get it in the other day. I got some questions in, but by the time things kind of played out, I didn't get it in. And I'm 99.9% sure that Mike Brown would not have answered it because they already indicated that he wasn't going to discuss details of the stadium deal. But I think the biggest question is how much are the Bengals going to pay?
Right.
Because the trend now is not what happened 20 years ago. In terms of where, you know, taxpayers and non-team funds picked up
the bigger foot. You have more private investment for these types
Correct.
Of projects.
However, you have all, it's a lot more money now. So you're looking at nearly, when it's all said and done to Paul Brown's, sorry, Paycor Stadium, you're going to be looking at in that $800 million to $1 billion range of improvements. And that's obviously going to be over several years. But when you look elsewhere in the NFL, the trend right now is about a 60-40. The Buffalo Bills are building a new stadium. The Tennessee Titans are building a new stadium. Around, generally speaking, it's the non-teams of the state, local government are putting in about 60%. And the NFL slash the team is putting in about 40%. Well, even when you look at $1 billion and you think, okay, even if the taxpayers are on the hook for 60%, well, that's a lot of money. And that's still more money than what we originally paid for the stadium. And so, yeah, percentage wise, I just don't see how the Bengals are going to get anywhere near the sweetheart deal they got last time. But I can also see them not wanting to follow the trend of the NFL. And, you know, expecting as close to a sweetheart of a deal as they got last time as possible. And you know, the Bengals have said, you know, they're going to put more money in, but that doesn't really mean anything. Of course, they're going to put more money in. It's more of a percentage as to what percentage are you going to pony up. And that's still just a big question right now. And that obviously we don't know.
Right. And then there, you know, it also brings to the forefront of this discussion, how else can the county benefit from the stadium? So the Taylor Swift concert, obviously, you know, a big example of how the stadium can work a little bit harder for the taxpayers. And that's always been one of the points Alicia Reese has tried to make, who I think she's currently the president of the commissioners right now. Is that right?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah. So, all right. Well, much more to come on that. It's so weird to be talking about football in July, but as we look out the windows of our perch high above Paycor Stadium, it looks like we have players actually on the field now because
they're practicing in the stadium.
While we're getting excited about football around the corner, we still have the Reds who are in contention right now. They are not mathematically eliminated after the All-Star break like last year. And we're going to be talking some baseball. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Because our special guest today, and I should have said it earlier, but you know, I'm subbing for, normally Sherry takes the lead here.
So yeah,
I'm flying without a net here. But 2 weeks ago, the Reds officially inducted Bronson Arroyo and Danny Graves into the Hall of Fame. We had Bronson Arroyo as a podcast guest shortly after the announcement was made. And now we're going to circle back. We're going to talk to the babyface assassin, the Reds all-time
Gravy.
Saves leader, Gravy as he's known. He was on that 1999 team that almost made the playoffs. I guess it was a playoff game.
One game playoff. That was a really good team.
That was a fantastic team. When I looked down at the roster of that team, you know, Sean Casey, Eddie Taubensee, you can go on and on. So we're going to talk to Danny Graves about what it means to be in the Reds Hall of Fame, what it was like playing on those teams. And you know, I had the opportunity to hear his acceptance speech at the Hall of Fame gala, and he was hilarious. So I'm looking forward to a spirited conversation with the one of the Reds' latest inductees to the Hall of Fame. So let's bring on Gravy. All right. right. It's special guest time on the That's So Cincinnati podcast. And with us now, patched in from where are you?
San Antonio, Texas.
San Antonio, Texas is Danny Graves. Danny, thanks for joining us.
Hey, my pleasure. Sorry it took so long to get back and just had to have things calm down a little. And here I am ready to talk.
Oh, that's awesome. So are you still riding that emotional high from the induction ceremony and induction week and all of that? I mean, that had to be a huge, huge moment in your life.
It was an unbelievable moment. And, you know, I keep feeling like I'm coming down off of that ride, but then, you know, I'll hear from random people and they'll ask me about it. And I feel like I get right back on the ride, which is great because I loved the ride. And, you know, coming back on here and talking to you guys about it, just, you know, it was a special time, man. I don't have a whole lot of words for it, but it was an amazing weekend. And thankfully I had somebody there to video a lot of it for me. Cam Miller, who does some short film for a lot of people in Cincinnati. He followed us around and he got a lot of good footage for me. So it was definitely an unbelievable weekend.
So I had the opportunity to be at the gala. And even though you didn't perform a concert like Bronson Arroyo did with his guitar, I thought your speech was phenomenal, funny, very personal. You had me in the audience laughing most of the time. And I thought it was really, really cool that the first standing O came from your mother when you announced that you were wrapping up your college degree. That was just such a cool moment there. So is that true?
Yeah. Well, the only lie about that was I said in 3 weeks, but I actually finished my last paper on Friday or Saturday. So I'm officially done. So now I'm just waiting for my diploma to be mailed. But it is official. It's official that it's over with. So that was the only lie.
Okay.
And I did tell her in 3 weeks. I didn't realize it was coming up so quick.
That's
but
fantastic.
Yes, that is a fact. And I knew she would be more excited about that than the Hall of Fame. She'd been begging me for decades now to go back and finish. So I finally got it done, man. And it's a really cool feeling. I mean, I don't know. I never thought I'd have a college degree, but I do now here. I'll be 50 next month and never thought that a 49-year-old would be able to get a college degree, but here we are.
Well, that's fantastic.
That's awesome.
So this is a fun topic to bring up because you were on a very fun Reds team, especially in 99 with the almost – well, we were talking about it earlier, if the one-game play-in counts as a playoff game. But when I'm looking at that roster, particularly in 99 – the teammates that you had, Sean Casey, Pokey Reese, Aaron Boone, Barry Larkin was still playing. That was a fun team to watch, and you were a big part of the fun. One of my favorite memories of that team, I don't know if it was that season, but watching you hit a home run, your first, if I'm not mistaken, your first hit as a major leaguer was a home run.
Yes. My first two hits were home runs. They weren't the first at bat. I went a few at bats. I think 11 at bats, maybe. But yeah, my first big league hit was a home run. And couldn't believe it. I don't think anybody else could believe it either.
Did you get the ball?
Yes. So Rob Butcher's usually the one who goes on the trips with us, but he wasn't there that series. So Mike Vassallo, who is now the Milwaukee Brewers PR director, he was the assistant at the time, and he ran into the Crawford boxes and begged the guy for the ball. And so he got the ball, and all the guy wanted was a Ken Griffey Jr. signed bat. Nothing from me. He just wanted a bat from Griffey. So I'm like, whatever it takes, if Griffey will do it, I would really like the ball. So thankfully Griffey did it for him. And so we got the ball back.
You still? Where's it at? Where's the ball?
I have it. It's here in my office.
Okay.
Oh yeah, I still have it. I have the bat too.
Oh, nice. Is that in your office too?
Yeah. Yeah, I do. And I have it sitting here, and it's a Travis Dawkins bat because I wasn't supposed to hit. It was crazy that I got a chance to bat because so we were in Houston and I had pitched the 9th and 10th inning and we were still tied. So the 11th inning was coming and my spot was coming up in the order. And, you know, obviously at that time managers had to think about who's going to hit for the pitcher if his spot comes up. So they told me, you're not going to hit if your spot comes up. So Hal Morris was there in the on deck batter's box. Getting ready to hit for me. So Pokey Reese ends up hitting a 3-run homer. So now we're winning 6-3 and they're screaming at me, go grab a bat. You're still going to be in the game. You're going to hit. So I'm like, all right. So I looked in the bat rack and grabbed a bat and it said Travis Dawkins. And I knew there wasn't many hits in that one that he had. So I grabbed it and it just happened to hit the right spot of the bat. And I'm telling you, this bat looks brand new because seriously, I don't think he had any hits with this bat. So I got the only hit with it.
That was 2000.
Yeah.
It's so you're right. It's very rare for a closer, before the era of the designated hitter in the National League to bat. And then in your speech, then you referenced the season that you were a starter and how that messed up your slugging percentage, which I thought was hilarious. But
go ahead. Sorry.
No, go ahead.
I was just trying to make light of a situation that, you know, it was a tough year, obviously. It was a time that I was kind of going through a divorce, but on top of that, like my starting was so hard for me. I just could not figure out how to be ready only every fifth day, as opposed to my whole life. Even all through college, I was a reliever. So, you know, high school I started because everybody starts in high school. But once I got to college, I'd never started a game again. And then, you know, you're used to this mentality of pitching every day or at least preparing yourself to pitch every day. Well, now as a starter, you got 4 days in between where you obviously do your work and you throw your bullpens and do your conditioning. But by the time the game starts, you got nothing to do. So I had 4 days of nothing. And, you know, if you had a bad game, you had to wait 4 more days to get back in the game. As a reliever, if you have a bad game, you still got a chance to pitch the next day. And I just never had an opportunity I never had the mentality to figure out like a good routine for a starter. And then, you know, pitching to guys multiple times in a game, you know, getting to the third or fourth at bat, they were making adjustments and I had never made the adjustments to pitch them differently, you know? So, it was tough. It was a tough year, but I took a lot of pride in it. And I actually led the team in innings pitched that year. And I led the team in complete games that year. So, you know, just trying to make light of the whole situation, it ruined my career batting average because I had a lot of at-bats and a lot of no hits, you know? So I got 6 singles that year and I think 50-something at-bats, and that's not very good.
I remember watching that home run and watching you run around the bases, and of course it was replayed a million times. You looked more surprised than anyone. Had you ever hit a home run in college?
No, I didn't even touch a bat in college. We had DHs in college too. The only bat I got to touch was if they needed somebody to hit fungos to the players before the game. Like there was no batting practice, no nothing for me.
Going deep is one of your God-given talents, I guess.
Well, I was always taught swing hard in case you hit it, you know, and that time I actually did hit it. It's just, you know, when I was 12, I could hit. But then guys started throwing harder and they started throwing breaking balls and stuff. And I just wasn't able to do it. So I just didn't care about hitting anymore. And when I got to college, we had, you know, at Miami, there was a lot of guys that they recruited. And a lot of them were big, strong kids that were, you know, only DHs. So there was really no opportunity to hit and I was fine with it. So when I got into the big leagues, I was with Cleveland. So obviously DH in that league. And when I got to Cincinnati, it was like, oh man, well, thankfully I'm a reliever because I'm not going to hit that much because I just guys throw too hard. You know, I'm not scared of the ball, but I just don't like to swing and miss.
Right.
So I'd rather just watch other guys swing and miss.
Yeah, Danny, you talked about, you know, that year you were a starter and how hard it was, and you bounce back from that. The next year you go back to being the closer of the team. You had what, 41 saves. You make the All-Star team. I don't think a lot of guys could have made that bounce back. Were you at a point in 03? Did you think maybe this is it, or was it ever in doubt that, like, if I can go back to the bullpen, I'll do my thing?
Yeah. So I was, begging to go back to the bullpen throughout 2003. You know, I just felt like at some point they got to realize that this isn't working and let somebody else have a chance to be a starter and put me back in the bullpen. And finally they did around August, or like towards the end of August. And from that point on, I felt like, okay, now I might actually have, be able to continue my career, because if I was going to continue to be a starter, I wasn't going to last very much longer, you know? And, I'm just grateful that they got me out of there. It took them 15 losses to realize that I wasn't very good as a starter. So, but yeah, going back to the bullpen, it was almost like rejuvenated my career. I didn't have the same stuff and I didn't throw as hard as I did before, but I still had the mentality of being a closer. And I think that obviously helped me, transition back into being that guy.
So going back to the Hall of Fame induction week, so there's so many stories, Danny Graves centered stories of these Reds teams. You know, you are like we said, all time save leader for the Reds, on some great teams. But your final season, in particular, your final game as a Red, probably didn't end the way you would have wanted it to if you wrote the Danny Graves story. Without getting into the details of that, was there a sense of the world being set right again, or vindication when you were selected in the Hall of Fame? Did that help kind of, you know, with some closure or how you felt about the team, how you felt about Cincinnati?
Well, I had no hard feelings towards the Cincinnati Reds or the city of Cincinnati. You know, it was just a unfortunate incident that happened with one particular fan.
Which, by the way, for the record, nobody thought that that guy didn't deserve it. At least, you know.
Well, thank you.
If there was a guy that deserved to be flipped off, it was that guy, you know. So,
yep. And I appreciate that. And I had a lot of new teammates and former teammates after that told me that they would have done a lot worse than what I did if they were talked to that way. But, you know, I don't condone that kind of behavior. It was just at a point where I'd had enough of my performance, you know, and this guy just leaned into the dugout. It's different if you're screaming at me from the stands and, you know, because everybody does that at some point. But, you know, he leaned in the dugout and literally was like 2 feet away from me, you know, screaming these things. And I did it. So when that happened, our GM at the time was Dan O'Brien, and he didn't even like talk to me about it, didn't say anything except until the next day. And he called on the phone and told me I was released. And I'm thinking, and I had talked to some, you know, Rob Butcher about it the night before, or like right after it happened. I talked to John Allen, who was the COO at the time. And we planned on having a press conference and me apologizing for my actions. But before that could happen, Dan O'Brien was on the road somewhere and he called the clubhouse and said that we're releasing you. And I'm like, releasing me? Because I did this to this guy? And he's like, no, that has nothing to do with it. It's because your performance hasn't been up to par. And I'm thinking, well, my performance has been terrible for a while, so why didn't you release me before? You know,
right.
It wasn't a coincidence that this is the time that you decide to do it. But all that being said, like, I had no issues with the city of Cincinnati. I had no issues with the ownership or the team, the organization. I just felt like when they released me, they didn't want me anymore around. So I went about my own business and tried to continue to play. And after I retired, I still, you know, wasn't trying to get back into being well-liked again. I just kind of let the Reds do what they wanted to do. And then when the Castellinis came along, they invited me back in and had with open arms and have been great ever since. So, and I know that the fans don't hold that stuff against me. There's a few here that'll get on Twitter and scream at me and say you flipped off all the fans in Cincinnati. And I'm like, well, actually it was only one guy that I flipped off. It wasn't everybody. In the
right.
Stands,
who said something pretty heinous. I won't even repeat it here, but people can look it up and do the story. Well, full disclosure, the editor of the Cincinnati Inquirer is a, unashamed, unabashed Reds fan. And, I'm among those fans who thought that at the time that was, you know, that you deserve to go out with a little more dignity. And so I was very happy to see, you know, when the announcement was made that you and Bronson Arroyo and Gabe Paul were going to be inducted this year. I felt that in a small way that the universe had like set itself right again. So for what that's worth.
Yeah, no, that means a lot. And, you know, when I hear like, the real fans of Cincinnati sports say stuff like that. And obviously you guys are true fans. It definitely means a lot because you speak for the real fans there too. And, you know, there's always a few bad apples here and there, but it's not going to, I'm not going to let that stuff ruin my days anymore. Back at that time when I was in a bad place and it, you know, things got to me a little bit differently, but I'm so grateful that this happened, this Hall of Fame thing. And I don't know if you were at the stadium when we did our little 2-minute speeches at the stadium, but I ended my speech saying, you know, this guy told me to go back to Vietnam, and which I did. I went back to visit, but now here I am getting ready to get my red jacket tomorrow. So, I mean, there's that.
Take that.
You know, and some people understood it. I had some people say, what are you talking about? And some people's like, that's so awesome that you said that. And, you know, I wasn't like trying to make a huge deal out of it, but I felt like I needed to say something about it. So,
Well played. Well played. So on a brighter note, At your longer speech, you actually had a spreadsheet up there with you, and you cut yourself off before you had gotten through your spreadsheet during your speech. So, not to put you on the spot, but was there something that you didn't have the time to say in your speech, a story or something that you weren't able to do because of time, because you gave yourself the hook? I was waiting for them to play like the end of the, you know, the Oscar speech when they take people off the stage. but they didn't do that, obviously. But what else, what was on that spreadsheet that you didn't get to say that you want to say?
So going into that, they told me that they weren't going to play music to kind of drive me off the stage. They wouldn't do that because I warned them. Because they initially said that we had 8 to 10 minutes to talk. And I said, well, a pretty good chance I'm going to talk longer than that. So just to let you know. And I think I did. Somebody told me it was close to 25 minutes long.
But it was all gold in my book. It was all gold in my book. I wouldn't have edited it down at all.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you. You know, and looking at the spreadsheet, I even looked at it. I'm looking at it again right now. When I got home that night, I put in red the things that I didn't get to say that I wanted to mention. I wanted to talk about Tom Browning at some point because we were really tight. We got to be pretty close towards definitely in my post career. He was such a good dude, and the first thing he ever said to me back in the clubhouse when I was playing is that he was proud that I was wearing number 32. And that meant a lot to me because I'd watched him growing up. You know, I grew up like 10 minutes from Plant City, where their spring training was for so many years. And you know, the Tampa Tarpons, their single A team, was right where I grew up. And so I knew Tom Browning, and not just because it's a perfect game. I mean, I knew these guys. And for him to say that to me, that meant a lot. And I wish I would have got a chance to say that. Why I didn't, I don't know. I was just kind of all over the place. And I warned everybody, too, that my ADD sometimes takes over and I just kind of go everywhere. So, and the other people I wanted to thank was the security staff around Great American Ballpark and all the police departments in the city of Cincinnati. Not that I was ever getting in trouble or not that they needed to get me out of trouble. I just feel like the security guards and the police officers don't get enough credit for what they do. They obviously taking care of the city, but I think they took care of us with, you know, special gloves just to make sure that we were able to go out and do our jobs every single day. And I know that probably sounds like a spoiled brat, but I felt very grateful for what they did for us, you know? So, I mean, really, those are the only two big things that I failed to mention. And I probably could have gone on and on and on that whole night, but at some point I had to stop and let Bronson play his guitar. So,
well, one of the things you also mentioned, if we can touch on it for a minute, is you mentioned, and I wrote the quote down, that you wanted to make sure that everyone listening to you understood that it's okay to not be okay. And you were talking about, in particular, your experience with depression. A few years ago, you had an interview with our beat writer at the time, Bobby Nightingale, where you were very open about what you went through after your playing days were over and how important it is to destigmatize it. That's been a something that you are now very open with. What did it take to get there? What did it take for you to become, you know, whether it was planned or not, an advocate for people getting help when they need help?
Well, the biggest thing, and I think it was Jim Day going on his podcast a few years back, and I was never one to just, you know, shy away from things, but nobody ever talked to me about like my mental health, except for my therapist and my family, you know? So like, it wasn't like somebody from the baseball world ever asked, oh, how's your mental health going or anything like that. So I never brought it up on my own. But when he asked me, it wasn't planned on that podcast. I don't know if you guys listened to it, but it wasn't planned. But we just started talking and he started asking me things. And then just, you know, I had no problem telling the world the issues that I had. And, you know, I feel like as a professional athlete, you have to try to be this machismo guy or, you know, have this, you know, so much testosterone where you can't look weak if you say that you have issues. And I wish I would have been a little more vocal back then, but I don't think there's ever too late of a time to remember to tell people that it's okay to not be okay, but I don't think it's okay to not talk to somebody about you not being okay. And you know, sometimes people don't want to go to therapist because of the you know, the whole demeanor of, well, I'm not crazy. Why should I go to the therapist? Well, just because you're not crazy doesn't mean you don't need a therapist. You know, sometimes you just need somebody to talk to or somebody just to be able to tell you that, hey, man, I've been there. I've felt that before, but, you know, don't let it beat you. We can get through this. You know, with all that said, I just think that my whole thing is I just want people to know that it's okay to tell people that you're not okay. You know, don't be bashful. Don't be ashamed of it. It's who we are. We all deal with different things on a daily basis. And, you know, there's times still that I'm not okay, but I have a good support system here with my wife and I see a therapist twice a month. So we all need people to talk to. You know, there's this joke about therapists that therapists need therapists. I shouldn't say joke, but it's a saying that, you know, everybody should have somebody to talk to that will listen and that won't be biased one way or the other, or won't try to say, oh, toughen up, because that was kind of what it was back in the day, toughen up. But that's not how it should be. Yeah. You know,
like, yeah, Danny, for you to open up about this is just really commend you for it and sharing about your story. And to encourage others and to show, yeah, it's okay not to be okay. And you opened up to our now former baseball writer, Bobby Nightingale, was it last year?
Yeah, a couple years ago.
And you really, I mean, you just laid it out there, and that's not easy to do. And you share details, and I just think that, to see where you're at today and to see versus where you were, and, you know, you talked about leaving the stadium and going home and drinking and taking Ambien, and I think you even said, like, it was hard for you because you had just signed a 3-year deal, multi-million dollar deal, and you're depressed. And yet, but you're like, how can I tell people I'm depressed? Like, they think I have everything I've got. And you're like, I did have everything, but it was all temporary. And I think that's really powerful that you shared that. And do you, I guess, what brought you to the point where you were able to talk about this stuff publicly?
Well, I think it helped going to therapists and making me more comfortable in talking about my situation and my issues that I was having. You know, for so long, when you are taught to not look weak, it's like that's all you know, just so you keep everything in. And I know that there's a lot of people these days that keep things in because they don't want to put a burden on somebody else, or they don't want to have people think that they're weak, or, you know, just this tough guy thing, or even, you know, with females, you know, females trying to be strong, and it's okay to try to be strong. But at the same time, if you're dealing with things, you have to talk to somebody. And, you know, when Jim Day did this podcast, and then Bobby, I did this thing with Bobby, and I mean, it was not hard for me to talk about. And, you know, Bobby's such a great writer. You know, he asked the right questions at the right time, and he knew how to just make me feel comfortable about opening up too, you know. And and I love Bobby for that. Bobby, both Bobby and Jim Day were both a critical part in my advocacy. You know, I get a lot of people because of those two. A lot of people are emailing me and reaching out to me and talking to me about things. And I've told people, if you email me, I'll email you back. Like, it's not like I'm going to blow you off. It's not just a thing that I'm saying. You know, in fact, some girl showed up at the Hall of Fame when I was doing a meet and greet thing. And she said, I'm Jessica so-and-so. I'm the one that emailed you. And I'd emailed her back twice, and she couldn't believe that I emailed her. And I just told her I was so glad to see you. And the smile on her face, you know, if you could just help one person feel better about themselves, like, how hard is that to do? But I should say it is hard to do if somebody doesn't know what you're going through, you know? So I just try not to be shameful about your situation, you know? And of course, it's going to take time to find the right person that you can open up with. But if you can't find that person, find a therapist.
Well, you give Jim Day a lot of credit. That night, he also gave you a lot of credit, tearfully thanking you for that conversation, because it encouraged him to address his own issues. So that was of all the moments that night, and there are many, many memorable moments, including Dave Parker scaring everybody for a brief moment. But I would say that moment where Jim thanked you for the impact you had on his life in that regard was probably one of the most powerful of the evening.
And, you know, I had somebody tell me about that. I didn't actually hear what he was saying because when I got back to my table, my kid fell asleep during my speech. So I was talking to him or trying to get him awake. And so, and then somebody said, well, Jim was just thanking you. So that's pretty awesome that he did that. But, you know, I just, some people that, I tried to thank a lot of people, and the people that helped me, whether it was during my career or post-career, and Jim Day was a huge part of that.
Well, I want to end just on just a couple fun things, kind of like going into the fast break here in our final minutes. When you talk about great pitchers, there's usually a great catcher that they're teamed up with, the battery mate. Who was your favorite catcher that you worked with?
Oh gosh.
One you were most locked in with?
Well, probably Jason LaRue. I threw to him the most out of any of the other ones, I believe, just because we played together for so long. A lot of the other ones were like Eddie Taubes, he was around for a few years, but Jason LaRue was really the main guy in my good years. And I think we got along so great. We always were on the same page, but he was a catcher that had no problem with me shaking him off, had no problem with, you know, talking to me about how do I want to approach a certain hitter. And, but the biggest thing with Jason, if somebody tried to steal, he was throwing him out. He had the best arm of a catcher that I ever played with. And the accuracy and the velocity on his throws, like if somebody got on in the ninth inning, I wasn't worried about them stealing because he was going to throw them out. And that's a big deal, or it was back then. Maybe it is now again, now that more guys are stealing bases. But you used to have to really take pride in holding runners. But with Jason back there, you didn't have to think about that much. You were able to concentrate on getting guys out and not, you know, controlling the running game.
Was there a batter that you most feared or dreaded?
So I was never really dreading facing a real hitter. I did not like facing pitchers when it wasn't a bunt situation. I know that sounds crazy, but it must have been a pride thing because I did not want to give up a hit to a pitcher.
Did that get in your head a little bit?
Huh?
Did that get in your head a little bit? Did you like...
Yes, of course. Of course it gets in your head. It did in mine. Yeah. Especially if it's a guy that you just think, oh, there's no way he can get a hit. And you throw him a cookie and he smokes it. It's just, I feel like you have to be more fine with the pitchers. You know, you can't throw it right over the middle of the plate and hope they get themselves out. Like some hitters, you can do that and you make a mistake, but they still get themselves out. Pitchers don't do that. If you throw it over the heart of the plate, they're going to crush it. And so, I mean, that's really the only fear I had of when I was on the mound facing a pitcher.
And then finally, when you were coming up, who in that clubhouse was your mentor? Who helped you figure out what it was like to be in the majors?
Pete Harnish. That's like hands down the number one guy. He took everybody in, no matter what your role was on the team and no matter what status you had as a big leaguer. He took me in, and we actually lived close to each other during the off season. So we golfed and worked out and did all the stuff together during the off season, preparing for the next year. But this was a guy that just, I mean, he did everything he could to make us younger guys better, whether it was on the field, you know, encouraging us to work out more and get in better conditioning. And he would always talk about, you know, the games the night before or what we were thinking and, you know, certain situations. And then off the field, too, like, this guy wanted to go eat lunch and dinner with teammates every single day. Just to hang out, you know, just so that we can all build that camaraderie. And from that point on, it's like, this is how it's supposed to be in a big league clubhouse. The guys are supposed to hang out, but guys are supposed to like each other. And he really taught me that.
You still talk to him?
I do. Yeah.
How's he doing?
He's He's up in New Jersey. So his son was he played at Fordham, same place that he played when he was in college. But then he ended up going to Santa Clara University last year, and some things happened there with him, so he didn't get to play a lot. I think he left. But Pete is just playing golf like all the time. I'm waiting for him to go on to the Senior Tour or Champions Tour, whatever they call it nowadays. Because I mean, he's a really good golfer, and he's the same funny, hysterical Pete that he ever was.
Yeah,
he's just an awesome dude, man.
It's awesome.
Well, Danny, we can't thank you enough for taking the time with us. Congratulations on your induction into the Hall of Fame. And also, just circling back, the impact you've made off the field since then is something that we want to help everybody understand that story too, because I think it's an important part of why you are so beloved by the fans to this day. I know there are a few that, you know, it is baseball.
There's always going
to
be a few, right?
There's always going to be a few, but it was exciting to watch that that whole, you know, Hall of Fame week, have you back in town. And thanks again for joining us on the podcast.
Well, thank you guys for having me. And I appreciate you letting me speak about that. And just thank you for backing me on that. I really appreciate it. And anytime you guys need a guest, if I'm available, feel free to reach out.
Well, maybe we'll have you guest host next time.
Oh, yeah.
That'd be fun.
I'm not good at asking questions. I'm just good at answering.
All right. That's
nice, Danny.
Thanks, Danny.
Okay, guys. Thanks.
Bye. All right. Well, we want to thank again Danny Graves for chatting with us. That was fantastic.
A lot of fun.
So, Jason, you haven't been on the podcast for a while, so I don't know if you've forgotten the format, but we like to wrap up by, you know, having a little bit of a discussion so that the podcast lives up to its name, you know, the That's So Cincinnati podcast. Have you had a That's So Cincinnati moment this summer that you would like to share with our listeners? I'm sure they're on the edge of their seats wanting to know your That's So Cincinnati moment of the summer.
I indeed have. I don't know if this is a, well, I'll just say it. Like, I think it's a great Cincinnati summertime thing, but riding the beast at Kings Island at night is a special, special treat. And there are no lights. There are no, in the speed of that roller coaster and going into that tunnel at night is, and the noise and the loud, and yes, it's the same noise you hear in the day, but there's a little something more intense about it when it's completely pitch dark.
You know, I'm thinking, I think I have ridden the beast at night, but way back in the day, like probably when the beast, I'm dating myself, like probably very early in the beast's history.
Yeah.
That's fantastic. Now, are you a roller coaster guy?
Not really, but this is second year in a row we've gotten a Kings Island pass.
Okay.
And so I was very adamant about this year, like, I've got to do the beast at night.
I thought you were going to say, I've got to get my money's worth for this pass. We're going to go.
Well, if you go twice, you get your money's worth. I think we've gone.
It is a good deal.
Three or four times. Yeah. So, but I was very like, okay, we're doing the beast at night this year.
That's fantastic.
And we did it earlier this month.
Your whole family, your two boys? Are they tall enough to get on the beast?
Yeah, they are.
Wow.
I did this with my older son, Reed. It was a big moment for him because he's a little. It's been quite an adventure with him and roller coasters.
Okay.
The younger one is like, he wants to ride. He's not tall enough yet for Orion, but he wants to do it all.
Yeah.
But I was like, the beast at night, Reed, let's do it. He did it, loved it. And he jumps off. He's like, this is the best day ever. He did. He literally was like, it's the best day ever.
That is fantastic. I remember when they first came out with the season passes, in my neighborhood anyway, people would flex their passes because, you know, it had their little picture on it and everything.
Yeah.
And it was definitely if you didn't have the Kings Island season pass, you felt like you were missing out on something. but it is a good deal. And so I haven't been for, gosh, it's been a while since I've been there. But what's the, what are your other favorite things to do when you go there?
Well, I love, I mean, Orion's great. I love, we have been doing this. We go with a group of friends. We haven't done it. We did it every time we went last year, and we would finish with a water ride because, you know, you're getting wet. And so you'd go home soaked.
That's good planning. So you're not walking around soaked all day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I do love that. I love that finishing up with a whitewater canyon or a Congo Falls. It's just, it's fun to, it's a different than what you had been doing the whole day or the whole evening. And we haven't done that this year. I've done some water rides, but we haven't done it to finish up the night.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Or the day.
I remember, watching the log flume. Before I got on it, trying to calculate like where would be the best place to sit if you didn't want to get wet.
Yes.
Because sometimes the front can be the place to be because the water shoots over your head and gets everybody in the back.
Right.
So I decided I was going to sit up in the front, and then we just took it like right down the throat.
We got totally wet.
We got, yeah, it was like someone turned a fire hose on it. You know, my, both my, my brothers and my sister worked at Kings Island
back in
the day.
Oh, yeah.
I think my sister worked in Rivertown Pizza.
Okay.
And I can't remember what was going on with my brothers. But, yeah, good times, man. Yeah. Good times. All right.
Beast at night, though. If it's like, it's almost like one of those Cincinnati summertime bucket list items, I feel like.
I think it's a good one.
Yeah,
I think that's good. All right,
well, that
was well worth the build up, Jason. I appreciate it, man. All right, well,
thanks for having me back on the podcast.
No problem. I think we're going to call that a podcast. Thanks everybody for listening. You can read all of Jason's columns and more as we follow the Reds, hopefully to the playoffs, on Cincinnati.com. If you're a subscriber, we thank you. If not, what are you waiting for? And we'll see you next week.